Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff. On the NewsHour tonight, a final farewell. George Floyd is laid to rest as his death becomes a rallying cry for change to America's legacy of treatment of African Americans. Then, race in the ranks. Multiple senior military leaders speak out about the need for equality in the United States Armed Forces. Plus, the pandemic abroad. Vietnam's intense coronavirus quarantine efforts have left the country relatively unscathed by COVID-19.
The public here in Vietnam has really bought into this. They really feel shared ownership of the problem of COVID-19. It's because of those early successes where the government was carrying out pretty strong measures.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Since our beginning, our business has been people and their financial well-being. That mission gives us purpose and a way forward. Today and always.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Johnson & Johnson.
The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, fostering informed and engaged communities. More at kf.org.
And with the ongoing support of these institutions. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
The Houston funeral of George Floyd has dominated the news of this day with vows that his death will not be in vain. Speakers at the service ranged from family to the famous, as we hear in our opening report from John Yang.
George Floyd was laid to rest today, more than 2 weeks after his death while being arrested by a white Minneapolis police officer, galvanized an international movement. At his Houston funeral, mourners celebrated Floyd's life and reflected on how his final words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry in the fight against systemic racism.
When he yelled, "Please, please, I can't breathe. I want justice for my brother, my big brother." That's Big Floyd. Everybody know who Big Floyd is now. Everybody gonna remember him around the world. He's gonna change the world.
His assignment turned into a purpose. And that purpose was around the world, that there are people rising up that will never sit down until you get justice.
My most favorite memory with my uncle was when he paid me to scratch his head after long days of work. We arrived at home. We even created a song about it called "Scratch My Head, Scratch My Head." Yeah. But after that, I knew he was a comedian. He always told me, "Baby girl, you're going to go so far with that beautiful smile and brains of yours."
While relatives remembered George Floyd, the man, presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, who met Monday with Floyd's family, said his legacy could be sweeping social change.
"I think what's happened here is one of those great inflection points in American history, for real, in terms of civil liberties, civil rights, and just treating people with dignity."
In Washington, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tim Scott of South Carolina, the chamber's only African-American Republican, is drafting a bill addressing racial discrimination in policing. The announcement comes a day after House and Senate Democrats introduced a sweeping measure of their own. Hours before Floyd's funeral, President Trump used a tweet to promote the conspiracy theory without offering evidence that a 75-year-old protester shoved to the ground by Buffalo police could be an Antifa provocateur taking part in a setup. The man, a longtime peace activist named Martin Gugino, remains hospitalized. The two officers involved have been suspended without pay and charged with felony assault. In a suggestion of growing unease with the president, some Republican senators distanced themselves from the tweet.
Yeah, I saw the tweet. It was a shocking thing to say, and I won't dignify it with any further comment.
Outside the White House, the Park Service says temporary fencing around Lafayette Park will be removed by Wednesday. But the protests in Washington, D.C. and across the country show no signs of relenting. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
Inside the church in Houston, the Reverend Al Sharpton delivered the eulogy for George Floyd. He honored Floyd's life and the movement sparked by his death.
You said you wanted to touch the world. Well, God had already made you for that. But you didn't touch it in a basketball court or football court. God had something else for you to do. Because all over the world, George, they're marching with your name. You've touched the world in South Africa. You touched the world in England. You've touched every one of the 50 states. Even in a pandemic, people are walking out in the streets, not even following social distancing, because you've touched the world. And as we lay you to rest today, the movement won't rest. Until we get justice, until we have one standard of justice. Your family's gonna miss you, George, but your nation is going to always remember your name.
Let's hear more about these moments at the funeral and the community's response. Matt Harab is with Houston Public Media. He was listening to the service at the church today. Matt Harab, thank you very much for talking with us. We know it wasn't just the Reverend Sharpton. There were other speakers today. What was the larger message that they were delivering?
Yeah, I think the larger message was one of action. You walk in the streets of Houston and you hear these protesters talking about how they want reform and they want justice. And it's one thing to hear words, it's another thing to see action. You heard in the speech today from Reverend Sharpton, along with his speeches in Minnesota, he mentioned slavery, he mentioned voting rights, he mentioned different time periods in American history where change was required, in their opinion. And this is one of them. And he continues to talk about police reform. And I think that is the larger message here, is the fact that these shouldn't just be words. These should be actions as well. And I think that's what people want to see.
Matt, we know you talked to people as they entered the church. Tell us about who was there. Tell us about whether they represent the wider Houston community. And what were they saying to you?
It wasn't just the Houston community. Sure, you had Houstonians come out and show their support, but I talked to a gentleman who drove here all the way from Tulsa, Oklahoma. He is a professor, and he wanted to be here because it's not only in support of George Floyd and the family, but he talked about how this is a historic event, and he wanted to be here simply because it is a historic event. I talked to a young woman who was talking about her brother and how she had been arrested brutally, and this is important for her to be here specifically to support him in addition to George Floyd. So you had a lot of people outside of the church as the service was going on, as the speeches were going on, all of them with different signs, Black Lives Matter, I Can't Breathe. And it wasn't just Houstonians. It was people across the country who traveled here amidst a global pandemic to be here today in support of George Floyd and his family.
And it is, in fact, it's not just a national movement. You could even argue it's international at this point. But, Matt, what are the leaders, local leaders there in Houston, saying about all this? How are they relating to it?
Well, one of the things that Mayor Sylvester Turner talked about in his speech today was how he's going to sign an executive order banning chokeholds by the Houston Police Department. Now, this is a police department that you have to remember, leading into George Floyd's death, we had six officer-involved shootings with civilians in the 5 weeks leading in to George Floyd's death. So there was a lot of momentum locally when it comes to police brutality. And then this kind of was just like a cherry on top. But I think that this, him announcing today, the mayor, that action is going to be taken. It's not just words. Banning chokeholds is one of the things that has been talked about when it comes to stopping police brutality. Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo was on the front lines in the Third Ward with protesters a couple of weeks ago as we marched from the Third Ward, the streets where George Floyd grew up, all the way to City Hall. So local leaders are taking it seriously. And we're just going to have to see what happens when it comes to the reaction from the local community for things like this chokehold ban, which the mayor announced today.
Matt Harab with Houston Public Media reporting on the funeral of George Floyd today. Matt, thank you very much. In the day's other news, the U.S. Senate confirmed General Charles Brown to be Air Force Chief of Staff. He's the nation's first black military service chief ever. The vote was 98-0. We'll focus on race in the military after the news summary. The World Health Organization tried today to clear up confusion over the spread of the coronavirus. On Monday, a top WHO researcher, Maria Van Kerkhove, appeared to say that infected people with no symptoms rarely transmit COVID-19. Today, she said she was referring only to a small sample of studies.
We do know that some people who are asymptomatic or some people who don't have symptoms can transmit the virus on. And so what we need to better understand is how many of the people in the population don't have symptoms, and separately, how many of those individuals go on to transmit to others.
Also today, the state of New Jersey lifted its stay-at-home order, and a Harvard Medical School study suggested that COVID-19 may have begun spreading in China as early as last August. World leaders will not convene this September for the annual United Nations General Assembly due to the pandemic. They may give recorded messages instead. It is the first time that has happened in the UN's 75-year history. In Hong Kong, hundreds marched today on the first anniversary of a rally that sparked a pro-democracy movement. They flooded the city's financial district, defying coronavirus restrictions. Riot police stood watch and made some arrests. City leader Carrie Lam warned today that the Chinese territory cannot afford any more chaos. North Korea announced today that it is cutting all communications with South Korea. Pyongyang blames Seoul for letting defectors and activists send leaflets with anti-North Korean messages floating across the border on balloons. The move comes as tensions on the peninsula are rising again. And on Wall Street, the ongoing market rally hit a rough patch and stocks were mostly down. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 300 points to close at 27,272. The Nasdaq edged 29 points higher to a new all-time high, but the S&P 500 slipped 25. Still to come on the NewsHour, multiple senior military leaders speak out about improving race relations in the United States Armed Forces. Why reporters of color may face different standards in newsrooms nationwide. As the coronavirus pandemic persists, we examine the practical realities of voting by mail and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
George Floyd's death has ignited new calls within the U.S. military to improve race relations. Today, the U.S. Air Force made history when the new chief of staff, General Charles Brown, was confirmed. Brown is the first African American to become the chief of a military service. Nick Schifrin has the story.
Nomination, General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., to be chief of staff and general of the United States Air Force.
For the first time in the Republic's 244-year history, the Senate confirmed a black officer, General Charles Brown, as a military service chief.
And thinking about a history of racial issues and my own experiences that didn't always sing of liberty and equality.
Last week, Brown posted an emotional video about what he was thinking about, racism in the military.
I'm thinking about the pressure I felt to perform error-free, especially for supervisors I perceive had expected less from me as an African-American. I'm thinking about wearing the same flight suit with the same wings on my chest as my peers, and then being questioned by another military member, "Are you a pilot?" I'm thinking about my mentors and how rarely I had a mentor that looked like me.
In this moment of national disquiet, the military is a crucible of race relations.
Really, you have to, more than talk about it, you gotta be willing to listen.
And it sparked admissions like these between outgoing Air Force Chief of Staff David Goldfein and top Air Force enlisted leader Chief Master Sergeant Kallith Wright.
We probably don't completely understand it because you and I have had different life experiences growing up.
You know, the fear I have when I'm driving down, whether it's the Beltway or any street around here, and I see blue lights, because I think it doesn't matter if I'm the chief or whomever. And my greatest fear is not for myself, it's that I wake up one day and one of our airmen will be George Floyd.
And to talk about race in the U.S. military, I'm joined by retired Major General Dana Pittard, who had a 34-year career in the Army, including overseeing the training of the Iraqi military, and retired Brigadier General Remo Butler, who had a 29-year career mostly in the Green Berets or Army Special Forces. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. Major General Pittard, let me start with you. What's the significance of General Brown becoming the first Black service chief today?
Well, thank you, Nick. Today was a really a great day in the history of our republic. General C.Q. Brown, who I've known over the years, is an excellent choice as the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. It's just too bad it's taken 244 years to have an African-American in charge of one of our services. But it's a great day either way.
Brigadier General Butler, the percentage of officers who are Black decreases with seniority. And at the same time, the percentage of enlisted who serve under the officers, the enlisted who are Black increases with seniority. Back in 97, you wrote an article called "Why Black Officers Fail." Have things changed in the last 23 years?
Not very much. The Black officers get promoted at about the same rate to the rank of captain. Once they make captain and move to the major, Lieutenant Colonel, they dramatically drop off. So the weeding out process starts then. And in the military, by the time you're a major, you probably have already had a couple of mentors. If you're a minority officer, many times you don't have a mentor. One, we're under the mistaken opinion a lot of times is that a mentor has to look like me. I've never had a Black mentor in Special Forces because they weren't there. But I've had some great white mentors in Special Forces. Throughout the military for many, many years, there are a lot of officers who feel that if you're a Black general, they did it because of affirmative action and you aren't smart enough. I remember when I first became a brigadier, they used to have this thing, and I don't know if they still do it. It was called a peer rating from the general. I didn't know that many general officers, but I got a lot of comments that said, not smart enough, not smart enough. And I went to a Latin general, and I said, what the heck is this? He says, don't worry about it. He said, I don't even read those things. He said, that's what a lot of people want to say. We aren't smart enough. But we are smart enough. The enlisted ranks have always been the worker bees. They're the ones that perform the labor. Get the troops in line. Get the troops on time. Get them to the mess hall. Get them back. They've always been working for white officers on many occasions. The enlisted folks have been accepted because they are under the officers. They're not officers. They're enlisted. They're lower caste, basically.
Major General Pittard, I wonder if you could comment on that, about the not only implicit racism that military leaders right now are admitting to, but also the explicit racism, perhaps, that you've experienced as well.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's still a legacy of systemic racism in our country. And the U.S. military, specifically the U.S. Army, is only a reflection of the society that it serves, no better or worse as far as racism. One would hope that it would actually be better because there's some things that the Army has done in the past that have actually been in front of society.
like the integration of units, the executive order by President Truman, I believe back in 1948, was well ahead of Brown versus the Board of Education in 1956. So there has been some good things there, but there's still this legacy of systemic racism, implicit bias that we see in units. And yes, you know, we had those peer ratings with general officers that General Butler mentioned, and sometimes they hurt your feelings as far as some things that were said, and you just kind of have to scratch your head on that. It is a plus today that General Brown was nominated and confirmed as the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. So absolute congratulations to him. But also we have some other things that we can be proud of. The superintendent of the United States Military Academy at West Point is African-American, General Darrell Williams. That's a big plus and a great role model. But throughout my career, from second lieutenant all the way through general officer, I experienced different aspects of racism in some ways. But again, we're not here to be victims. And General Butler, who I've got great respect for, who was the senior most African-American general officer in the Special Forces when he retired, is a great example of a person who has overcome obstacles and challenges and has risen to the occasion, like so many of us have had to do. But it's too bad that in many ways we have to do double the work, double the effort, just to get the same kind of recognition as our peers.
Brigadier General Butler, I wondered if you could comment on where we are today. We've seen so many senior military officials talk about the importance of changing the culture in the military. And we even saw the Marine Commandant recently banning the display of the Confederate flag. But at the same time, the Army just said it would consider renaming bases for Confederate generals. How fast is the military moving forward on this issue, and is it moving with one voice?
Can't tell you if it's moving with one voice or not. These are just my opinions. Remo Butler. Number one, I'm not really interested in the names of the bases. I mean, I understand it. AP Hill, Bragg, I understand. They were Confederate generals. I understand that. I would rather the military work at the systemic problems, i.e. promotions and command selections, from minority officers. That's where the problem is. If you don't have the right command, you're not going far. You'll go up. And if you look at the systemic thing, 1997, I wrote a paper, Why Black Officers Fail. 2010, Lieutenant Colonel Smith wrote a paper, Why Black Officers Continue to Fail, or something to that. 2020, there's another one written by another War College person. And he goes into the history of why there is systemic issues in the military. So I think we've made some progress, but not a lot of progress. You know, people don't see the problem until it affects them. The people in power, it's not affecting them. You look at the George Floyd thing. People never saw this before because everybody didn't have videos. Now we have video. Now people can see things that are happening. That's why you're getting more protesters, because now they feel the effects of it. And I think that, you know, the military is a great organization. The Army is great. I enjoyed my time in it. But I think that more could be done.
And those military leaders who are in charge right now do say and admit that more needs to be done. And they say that they are going to do more in the future. Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there. Brigadier General Butler, Major General Pittard, thank you very much to you both.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
The death of George Floyd and the protests since have reignited enormous questions about race and racism, inequality and discrimination in America. That is true as well for the work that we do, news reporting. There have been a number of developments on that front of late, including a decision by editors at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette to initially pull an African-American reporter off protest coverage following her tweet. Her white colleague also was warned about a tweet he made, but was not pulled off coverage until later. That and other incidents have crystallized some of the differences in the experiences of black journalists as contrasted with their colleagues. We explore this and some of the larger issues behind all this with Dorothy Tucker. She's president of the National Association of Black Journalists. And Norman Perlstein. He's the executive editor of the Los Angeles Times. And we welcome both of you to the NewsHour. Dorothy Tucker, you told one of my colleagues this afternoon, you said this has been a difficult time for black journalists. You described them as frustrated and tired, angry and scared. That's a lot to carry around at a time when reporters are being asked to cover all of this.
Well, Judy, you know, quite honestly, some of that is what we carry all the time anyway. But it definitely is harder these days. You know, I mean, from my own personal experience, I can tell you in covering the protest, I worked over the weekend. I worked, you know, 3 or 4 days in a row, and I'm asking questions of people and I'm interviewing people on this side of the brain. But on the other side of the brain, I'm thinking of my 28-year-old son who was traveling from Atlanta to Chicago driving and praying the entire time that he arrives home safely. You know, that he doesn't get stopped by a police officer, that something doesn't happen to him when he stops at a rest stop. You know, so this is something that we carry with us. When you're covering a protest like this and you have had experiences of racism, you have witnessed it, you know someone who has had a negative exchange with a police officer. So, you know, this is what we live. And to have to now be wear both of those hats, it is frustrating, it is tiring, and at times, because you are in the middle of it, it is scary.
Norman Perlstein, what are you hearing from reporters you know, reporters who work for you who are African American?
Well, they are speaking very much about the same kinds of pressures and tensions that you were just hearing about. They are also commenting quite passionately about the fact that there are not nearly enough black journalists working at the Los Angeles Times, and that puts an additional burden on those who are here.
And Norm Perlstein, are there enough? And if not, why not?
Well, I think there has been a pattern of underrepresentation for a very long time in all of our publications in the U.S., but it has been especially true at the Los Angeles Times. We live in a progressive community. We live in a city that is 47% Hispanic, that has a very active black population that is represented in politics much more than it is in journalism.
And Dorothy Tucker, how much difference? I know you have these discussions with colleagues. You certainly discuss it at the National Association of Black Journalists. How much difference is it believed that it would make if there were more journalists of color and more journalists of color in positions where decisions are made?
And that is the key, Judy. It's not just about having an increased number of journalists there. It is important that we see blacks in management position so that the stories that we cover, I think you would see more equitable reporting in the stories that we cover, in the kinds of stories that we cover. You know, I think for African Americans who are reporting, they come to the editorial meetings with ideas. You know, they come with pitches, and oftentimes they're just not accepted. Perhaps if there were black managers there, there would be a better chance of some of the ideas that they're having, the kind of stories that they would like to do. You know, I think those managers would be more sensitive to that. You know, I think just having more black managers would mean that some of the missteps that we've seen, you would not see. You wouldn't see the case of what happened in Pittsburgh. You wouldn't see the headline that we saw in Philadelphia. You wouldn't necessarily see what we saw at the New York Times. The list is long. You need someone of color, an African American, at the table when decisions are made to prevent the kind of missteps that we have seen in the media recently.
One of the active debates we had over the past week was about the use of the word looting to describe the destruction of property and the very much the feeling among the black journalists at the Los Angeles Times, who frankly educated the rest of us to the fact that looting had a pejorative racist connotation, and that comparing it to the kind of behavior of the police and the kind of behavior that we witnessed really was a false equivalency, and yet it was one that we were making as journalists if you picked up a copy of our paper.
And so that's a great conversation to have. I mean, the word riot is very similar. You know, there is concern that it is automatically labeled as a riot if it is African Americans who are protesting, but it's not labeled as a riot when you see the same kind of destruction after a concert or, you know, after a sporting event. So there are words that have that association. So I appreciate the fact that you're having that kind of discussion at the LA Times.
It's a conversation about words. It's also we're increasingly hearing this conversation about this idea, this traditional idea in the press of neutrality versus what some are saying now when it comes to subjects like race, where journalists are called on to speak with what they are calling moral clarity, Norm Pearlstein, even if that means they've stepped from pure neutrality into expressing an opinion. I mean, I guess my question is journalism changing in that regard?
Well, I think it's changing only in the expansion of the definition. We don't think twice about saying that anti-fascism would be part of our mandate as a journalistic institution. Anti-racism certainly should be similarly central to our core. I think that the danger is that we not only recognize the need to tell stories, but that we also need to have a moral purpose. Otherwise, I think that the freedoms that we get with the First Amendment are not deserved.
Dorothy Tucker, is what's going on today calling on us to re-examine, again, that traditional definition of journalism as all about neutrality?
You know, I think what is happening today is more than anything calling on news managers and news outlets to just really pay attention to the varying voices in their newsrooms. Now, when it comes to just whether we should, you know, step over a line, I don't think anyone is asking for that. I mean, we're journalists and we're going to be fair and we're going to be accurate. But at the same time, if the information that someone is putting out there is wrong, you know, I think as journalists, as you well know, it is our job to point that out. You know, if what somebody is saying to you is unfair and racist, as journalists, it is our job to point that out. And I think what you're seeing more today is that journalists are more comfortable in doing that. I think that's where the change may be.
I think there is some parallel to during the Vietnam period, when journalists like David Halberstam were certainly letting their opinions into their journalism, and I think it was for the better.
It's a big subject, and we so appreciate both of you talking with us today. Norm Pearlstein, Los Angeles Times, Dorothy Tucker, reporter in Chicago and president of the National Association of Black Journalists. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It is election day in five states, including Georgia, where voters face broken voting machines and hours-long lines in the heat. Georgia's Secretary of State called the situation unacceptable and ordered an investigation into voting problems in the Atlanta area. Georgia also had fewer poll workers in place due to the pandemic. With the coronavirus still present in all 50 states, officials around the country are trying to determine how to hold this fall's elections while keeping voters safe. One of the key ways is voting by mail. But as William Brangham reports, President Trump and the Republican Party are casting unproven allegations about the process.
When you do all mail-in voting ballots, you're asking for fraud.
Less than 6 months from Election Day, President Trump is trying to undermine a process through which millions of Americans currently cast their vote, through the mail.
The practice allows voters to receive a ballot in the mail, fill it out at home, and then mail it back in or drop it off at a secure location. That rather than going to a physical polling place and casting your vote.
Absentee voting is traditionally a type of mail-in voting where you need to be approved to receive a ballot, and some states have stricter requirements than others. ProPublica's Jessica Huseman says mail-in voting has been around for a long time.
People have been voting by mail since the Civil War. We sent ballots to soldiers during the Civil War, and they returned them by mail. So this is certainly not something that's new in American history, and in the last several years, it's gotten even more common.
But now, given the pandemic and the risk of infection whenever people are crowded together, election officials in many states want to avoid a repeat of this, where some Wisconsin voters crowded into long lines for hours for an election in April. With growing health concerns, more than 60% of all votes cast in that state were cast by mail. That included Middleton residents Brady Minter and his wife Michelle, whose daughter Emmy has a congenital heart defect.
Anybody who's been to a voting poll knows how cramped the spaces can be. And so it was really kind of an easy decision given our personal concerns with our daughter having some heart issues. Barring any sort of unexpected events, we would do the same thing in November.
People should not have to choose between voting and preserving their good health.
But that hasn't stopped the president from lashing out at Democratic officials in Congress and in key battleground states who are trying to expand vote by mail. This while voter turnout falls amid the pandemic.
If people mail in ballots, there's a lot of illegality.
The president has accused them, with no evidence, of trying to rig the 2020 election. The president threatened to withhold federal aid from Michigan for sending out vote-by-mail applications to registered voters, and Nevada because its Republican Secretary of State sent out mail-in ballots. Both are legal in those states.
We don't want them to do mail-in ballots. We don't want anyone to do mail-in ballots.
The president himself votes with a mail-in ballot from Florida, his legal state of residence.
If you need it for some reason, or if somebody's not well, that's one thing, but when you send out 7.7 million mail-in ballots, there's forgeries.
The president's campaign against vote by mail comes as public support for it is rising amid the pandemic. In a recent PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll, just over half of voters said they would vote by mail in November if given the option. But the partisan divide is stark. About 60% of Democrats say they would, compared to only about 40% of Republicans. 56% of Republicans say they would still vote in person.
Many people have been voting by mail for a very long time, including our military and overseas voters.
Tammy Patrick is a former elections official in Arizona. She's now a senior advisor at the bipartisan foundation Democracy Fund.
We have heard the president and many others make accusations that voting by mail is an invitation to widespread fraud. Is there any evidence that that's true?
No. There is no evidence that that is true. And I will say that we already have tens of millions of Americans voting by mail. For tens of millions of Americans, they have their ballot handed to them by a postal carrier, not a poll worker. In many places, you have signature verification when the application comes in. So it's compared to your voter registration form. In many places, that same signature type of verification is also done on the ballot envelope. There are other security measures where auditing takes place that looks to see where are places that we're getting things that are coming in late, or we're seeing abnormal activity from what we've seen in the past.
In the 2016 election, more than 33 million Americans voted using mail-in ballots. Experts expect that number to more than triple in 2020. Five states, Colorado, Hawaii, Oregon, Washington, and Utah, already conduct their elections entirely by mail, with California looking to join them this year because of the pandemic. While there's no evidence of widespread fraud with mail-in or absentee ballots, it does occasionally happen. One recent case happened in a 2018 North Carolina congressional race where a Republican operative illegally gathered and submitted ballots.
You know, I don't want to discount the concerns over voter fraud, especially when it comes to vote by mail, because the instances of fraud that we've seen in the last couple of years have been with absentee ballots. So these things do happen. There are all kinds of voter fraud does happen, but is exceedingly rare.
And while the president is attacking Democratic-led states, officials in red states, like in Georgia, are also trying to expand mail-in voting.
I don't think that it is a surprise or a shock that the states that he's denigrating are Democratic-leaning and the states that he's applauding are Republican-leaning. So this is not necessarily about the security of vote by mail. It's about who will vote Republican and who won't.
It is an absolute brazen power grab. And
the Republican National Committee, led by Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, is now suing California to stop that blue state from mailing absentee ballots to all registered voters. The president's made false claims about who was, in fact, receiving ballots in the Golden State.
People that aren't citizens, illegals, anybody that walks in California is going to get a ballot.
It is those individual states, not the federal government, that determine the rules for how votes will be cast in November. And in the face of the pandemic, more states, both red and blue, are looking to expand absentee and vote-by-mail options. And so far, the Trump campaign and state Republican officials are still encouraging their voters to vote that way, if they choose. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
As cases of coronavirus continue to spike overseas, notably in Brazil and India, one nation from the outset sought to beat COVID-19 and has apparently succeeded, Vietnam. Bordering China, the similarly authoritarian country instituted mass quarantines and social distancing. And as special correspondent Mike Saray reports, they flattened the curve.
When China sneezes, Vietnam is the first to catch the cold, as the Vietnamese like to say. Given their shared border, the 2003 SARS virus outbreak spread from China to Vietnam first. With fewer than 1,000 ICU beds for its more than 90 million people, this time Vietnam simply couldn't afford to let the coronavirus spread out of control and overrun its healthcare system. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control's representative in Hanoi is Dr. Matt Moore.
The public here in Vietnam has really bought into this. They really feel shared ownership of the problem of COVID-19. And I think, again, it's because of those early successes where the government was carrying out pretty strong measures that, for us in the West, we might consider them to be sort of draconian, but they were really effective.
Vietnam and the U.S. had their first COVID cases the same week at the end of January. But Vietnam's pandemic task force was operational in a week instead of a month for its U.S. counterpart. Both countries issued air travel bans from China and abroad, but Vietnam also medically screened international arrivals, requiring 14-day self-quarantines and mandatory quarantines for those traced to anyone with symptoms or testing positive. Until it could ramp up its limited testing capacity, Vietnam targeted hotspots, quarantined those testing positive at medical facilities, and contact traced those they had been in contact with. They were quarantined usually at military sites for 2 weeks or until they tested negative. Vietnam's shelter-in-place and social distancing restrictions were also more strictly enforced.
It takes a lot of human resource to track contacts of potential cases and control these clusters, and they did have the human resources to do that.
Dr. Todd Pollack heads up the Harvard Medical School's Partnership for Health Advancement in Vietnam. He and other Western medical advisors believe Vietnam's relatively low COVID numbers are generally backed up by what they observed throughout the crisis.
We can look at the number of patients admitted to the hospitals. Because in Vietnam, they have a policy to isolate all positive cases in health facilities. If it was hit with the thousands, 10,000s, hundreds of thousands of cases that are being seen in other countries, it also would be overwhelmed like other countries. But at the current state, that's not the situation here.
The majority of them were treated at the National Hospital for Tropical Diseases, which had extra capacity and supplies throughout the crisis, according to Dr. Thi Hai Nhin, head of internal medicine.
Vietnam is a developing country, and our resources are limited. So at the beginning of the pandemic, we tried to restrict the number of the patients.
Vietnam literally declared war on the coronavirus. The military was mobilized for healthcare missions, and their bases converted to mandatory quarantine sites. Its largest manufacturing companies converted to producing PPE and test kits, which they are now exporting to the U.S. A mobile app was created for updating COVID hotspot locations and their proximity. COVID got the full enemy treatment on Vietnam's ubiquitous propaganda billboards. Its pop stars banded together to help communicate critical hygiene messaging and rally the country for what was considered to be a personal health and national security threat.
There is good medical care here. It's just that the availability of it, the volume of it, is nowhere near a developed country. And because of that, I think, you know, the country and the people here, in terms of its leadership and the people, take these situations much more seriously.
Henry Nguyen is a Vietnamese-American businessman living in Ho Chi Minh City, whom we profiled previously on the NewsHour. As the owner of the local McDonald's restaurants and also having a U.S. medical degree, he believes cultural differences allowed the Vietnamese to be more accepting of stricter containment measures than Americans, despite Vietnam having fewer COVID cases.
In the larger picture, maybe there is a little bit more what I'll call a sense of communality in terms of togetherness here, that people say, this is the sacrifice I make for the better good of my, you know, family, my community, my city, my country.
Many attribute Vietnam's relative success to its more authoritarian style of government, which allowed for more aggressive and enforced containment measures that could be implemented without delay, public debate, or the civil liberties and privacy issues Americans are guaranteed. Human rights critics fear the government took advantage of the crisis to further advance its public surveillance and online censorship agenda.
We shouldn't ignore the fact that the beliefs and the support of the population are so key in this kind of situation.
One of the first countries outside of China to start shutting down, Vietnam was one of the first to start reopening at the end of April, starting in areas that had gone 21 days without any new community spread COVID cases, as they continue to follow their so far successful COVID-19 containment strategy. I'm Mike Saray for the PBS NewsHour.
California's Governor Gavin Newsom has just announced a limited reopening of some movie theaters on Friday. But big chains, including AMC theaters, have said they fear for their very survival. The pandemic continues to bring chaos to the more than $42 billion global movie business. Jeffrey Brown reports for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
This summer's blockbusters for now not coming to a theater near you, as one by one, Mulan, Wonder Woman 1984, and so many other films have been put on hold. Kim Masters is editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of public station KCRW's The Business.
The movie industry and the entertainment industry more broadly is in a state of paralysis more or less right now. And what you see is anything with a significant budget is getting pushed.
A major test case, Master says, Tenet, a big movie by a big-time director, Christopher Nolan, of Dunkirk and the Dark Knight films.
To do what I do, I need some idea of the threat we face.
Tenet, a mind-bending, time-warping thriller, was expected to be one of the summer's box office hits, with an opening mid-July. But will that release date hold up?
Many people in the industry think this is simply unrealistic. I think Christopher Nolan's idea was, my movie will lead the way, and people will come, and the world will start to return to itself. But I don't think in many places there's a feeling so strongly that the world is returning to itself that we're streaming into the theaters.
Where we are streaming, of course, is in our homes, streaming video on our small screens. Netflix and other services had already been challenging and changing the Hollywood economic model. The pandemic pushed that further. In April, Universal released its animated sequel, Trolls World Tour, directly to streaming, charging $19.99. It took in more than $100 million in its first 3 weeks, more than the original Trolls film made in 2016 with a traditional theater release. Eye-opening for sure, but not, says Masters, game-changing.
You could do that with a certain type of movie. I mean, Trolls, they had all kinds of reasons for doing it. They had already spent, even just in this country, say $40 million to advertise it. It was a known property. It was a kids movie in a time of pandemic. It was a bit of a one-off. You can't extrapolate.
Most movies, that is, still need theaters. But who's ready to return to the local multiplex?
We are going to have more debt at the end of this with no income and probably less income for the remainder of the year. So to say it's scary is sort of an understatement.
Bobby Bagby is executive vice president of B&B Theaters, the nation's sixth largest theater chain with more than 400 screens across 7 states. It's a family-owned company that dates to 1924.
We've gone through wars and the 9/11, the Great Depression. I mean, you name it, we've kind of been through those times. And while they've been hard, we've been able to remain open. This is the first time in our history that every single one of our locations has been closed and with zero income coming in.
Now, theater owners everywhere need to lure audiences back. It's no longer about the popcorn and the films, but about feeling safe. And that means changing the physical space.
Lots of obviously extra cleaning procedures are taking place. We're staggering seats. It means we're losing every other or every third seat, depending on the auditorium layout. So it's less people coming into the building, even if we could be at full capacity. I think people are ready to get out. I think storytelling and escaping to the magic of the movies is sort of in our core as America. We're doing everything we can to try to protect our staff and our guests as they come back. But I don't know what the future holds.
It may hold a return to the past of drive-in theaters. There are just about 320 left, but they're having a sudden resurgence. At a Salt Lake City drive-in recently, cars parked 2 spaces apart. And Haley Dietz and her daughter enjoyed the horror film The Hunt, an escape from our national real-life horror.
This is probably my 4th or 5th time out of my house in 2 months.
In fact, drive-in theaters themselves began as a response to earlier changes in American culture, numbering more than 4,000 in their heyday in the post-war, car-loving, suburbanizing America of the 1950s. And there's a lesson there for us now, says theater historian Kevin Corbett of Central Michigan University.
In many ways, the history of movie theaters is actually a history of those theaters having to respond to threats. We can go back to at least as far as the 1930s and the Great Depression, when fewer and fewer people were spending what money they had on going to movies.
One way to bring them in, popcorn. The concession stand, it turns out, was a major innovation for its time. Just as more recently, many theaters have added plush, vibrating seats and concierge service, making themselves entertainment destinations in response to the threat from the comfort of home viewing offered by streaming services. That history gives Kevin Corbett reason for optimism.
Given the fact that theaters now have survived a variety of threats for, you could literally say 120 years now, because turn of the 20th century is when actual movie theaters first appeared. I don't foresee this pandemic, this particular threat, ending movie theaters. I'm convinced people have always and will always want to be out and entertained in groups. That alone will allow theaters to continue to exist.
Maybe so, For now, the superheroes, animated adventurers, and Tom Cruise's Top Gun sequel all await their return to the big screen. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
And we can't wait for movies to come back. On the NewsHour online right now, many in the U.S. are without a roadmap for how to assess coronavirus risks as parts of public life, like going to the movie theater, resume. We asked public health experts about ways to get out of the house while limiting the chance of infection. You'll find a helpful chart that's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
Life isn't a straight line, and sometimes you can find yourself heading in a new direction. Fidelity is here to help you work through the unexpected with financial planning and advice for today and tomorrow.
Consumer Cellular. Financial services firm, Raymond James. Johnson & Johnson. Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. And with the ongoing support of these individuals and institutions. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
PBS.